Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
And we are recording. And I'm lucky enough to have with me today Dr. Eleanor Gross, who's a neuroscientist with a PhD in clinical research, specifically ketosis in migraine prevention. And she's the CEO and founder at Keto Swiss. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Ali. Pleasure.
So can you talk us through your story where you go from migraine sufferer to PhD in migraine prevention with a company specializing in migraine prevention?
Yeah, sure. So I think it all started fairly early on. I was a very sick baby and liver failure almost. And then it got a little bit better after being 1 year old. But even in my childhood, I used to be always sick with like colds, flus. And then when I got older, it got a little bit worse after puberty. So puberty is roughly when migraine started. But even then, nobody could figure out that it actually was migraine. So they were sending me to psychologists and had my brain scanned, EEG done. Thought it was a tumor or whatnot, a one-sided headaches, which is the biggest sign for migraine. Nobody could even basically diagnose, right? So we were running around for 1 year until my mom remembered that my grandma had similar headaches and sickness and these associated noise, light, smell sensitivity symptoms. So then we Googled the issue. That by that time, Google and computers had appeared and the internet. And so we found ourselves and then had it also basically a specialist clinic, neurology clinic, then had it seconded our opinion and said that was migraines. But that's how it all started. And then went to school, did that, wanted to be a psychotherapist at some point. So I started doing psychology, trying to understand better how the brain works, something between arts and science that was nice, see how we think and how we behave. And the brain had always fascinated me. But then towards the end of my degrees, those migraines had become chronic. So that means I had more than 50% of the months in pain. And for those of you that have migraine or relatives or friends that have migraine, they might know that you're only allowed to take triptans or painkillers on about 10 days per month. That's the absolute maximum in order to not get an overuse medication, overuse headache, or become addicted or have liver failure or other bad things. So that means I had an average of about 20 days with migraines a month. But that means 10 days you're left alone in a dark room, feeling nauseous, not being able to move, not being able to think very well. So you can't really do anything during that time. It's a complete loss of time. So I was fully aware that I could never hold down a normal job anyway, in that way. And so towards the end of my degree, I decided I'm going to swap into neuroscience, which luckily I did. And that was in more the medical department. So within my master's in neuroscience, I could do two master's projects, one with stem cell research, one with neuroimaging, and that was both focused on migraine. And I got to know more migraine patients, chronic migraine patients, got to work with them, do research on them, and started to develop a theory on what migraines really are. So that was my goal, find out what are migraines, because none of the specialists that I saw in like 10, 15 years of having migraines could tell me what's going on and why. And even my supervisor, genius, was not able to explain to me what are migraines, why do they happen, and what can we do about it. And so I started to form this theory that migraines are actually an energy deficit in the brain. But one day, working in neuroimaging with chronic migraine patients, the scanner broke down, and that one patient had to come back 2 weeks later. And this was really one of those key moments in your life, where she came back and she looked completely different. I couldn't recognize her at first. She lost weight. She was walking upright. She was smiling. She was beaming. She looked healthy and well. And I asked her, what have you done? And she told me that she had been fasting for 2 weeks. And for me, this was like, what is going on, right? Neuroscience in Oxford, we learned that the brain can only feed off glucose, more or less, right? and energy deficit in the brain. Now, this person hasn't been eating for 2 weeks and her migraines are gone. How is that possible? She should have collapsed and died. And she even drank a glass of red wine every night. And for those that have migraine, know this is one of the most potent triggers for a lot of patients. So it completely didn't make any sense. That was more towards the beginning of my degree. And that didn't leave me alone. And at some point, procrastinating from my second master thesis in the library, I was sitting there flicking through a Nature version. And Nature, some of you might, it's like a renowned science magazine. And they had an epilepsy special in there. And at this point, I already knew that migraine and epilepsy are actually more related than probably attention type headache and migraine. So some migraine babies or children grow out of it and get migraines instead. So a lot of the mechanisms and genetics are actually shared between the two conditions. And in that special, I read about the oldest treatment for epilepsy, the ketogenic diet. And now finally, everything made sense. You know, that patient not having eaten 2 weeks, her brain was fed for the first time. And that's so ironic. So the whole idea that we can eat and starve at the same time, we can eat and starve ourselves, that just came to me right then. And that's kind of counterintuitive, but in a way now it made sense. So the brain can actually feed off something else than glucose, lactate as well. But now it made sense. The whole fasting thing, and I knew this is what I want to do with my PhD. I want to find out what is going on in ketosis and migraine. Could this be a better or an alternative therapy to all these drugs that I've been taking at this until this stage? So in order to finish my degree in Oxford, I had to take strong anticonvulsants, so epileptic drugs, and they made me dement. So I would sit with my best friends at a coffee, and I wouldn't know her name, and it wouldn't come back to me for 2 weeks. It's the same. You wake up, you don't know where you are. Just everyday words are lost. It was really scary. And all these medications that we have for migraine prevention, they come with intolerable side effects, almost all of them. And over time, you have to increase your dose. So I can safely say after that, I started self-experimentation. There wasn't a lot online 7 years ago, so it all failed. I was eating too much protein. But when I finally got it right, I got my brain back. And that was the most beautiful moment ever. And I still do to this day. I'm not in ketosis anymore. Sometimes I eat carbs, I eat fruit. I don't eat crappy carbs, but I'm more of a paleo kind of a person now. And after 2.5 years in ketosis, my brain didn't need to be in ketosis anymore. And because I love food, we've previously discussed this before the show, I love cooking, I love eating. So I also experimented with exogenous ketones even 5 years back. And that did me almost as well, or with a combination with a low carb diet that always also did a lot of good things for me. And this is when Keto Swiss arose, right? Because a lot of patients have compliance issue, especially the transition from having had carbs for all of your life, right? Never been in ketosis outside of being a baby and having mother's milk, to this super strict ketogenic diet where your liver doesn't even know how to make ketones anymore and how to transport them. And this transition period can be the worst. And I think this is where exogenous ketones can be very helpful to offer the brain an alternative energy substrate while glucose is unavailable and we're not yet making ketones. And I think in the long run, some patients where there's a sluggish liver, they can benefit from adding exogenous ketones on top of it because they don't get into therapeutic levels. For example, my liver function is still compromised. And if I'm not well, my ketone bodies are non-existent, even if I'm on a ketogenic diet. And now I've talked for so much, but anyway, so in the end, in Switzerland, I could do this PhD that would let me, even though it was risky. So I left Oxford, went to Basel, Switzerland. I'm still here now, finished my PhD last year on exogenous ketones and migraine prevention. Exogenous ketones, just because if you do a ketogenic diet, firstly, it's super hard to get funding. You probably will never get it because it's a dietary intervention. So many things that you can't control. So very hard from a strict scientific perspective, right? And also, if you're trying to find out what do ketone bodies do in migraine, and you're changing a crappy standard Western diet to a whole foods-based ketogenic diet with now more fats, more protein, so many other changes, less processed foods, you cannot say in the end what did the change, right? You can only say that this kind of a dietary change with all these variables is doing X, Y, and Z. If you're adding exogenous ketones and that's the only thing you're doing, you can safely say that it's not the absence of glucose, it's not the addition of some kind of a fatty acid or protein, it's just the ketone bodies and they're doing that. And this is what we decided to do in the end. Not perfect, but from a research perspective can maybe answer some questions, and currently data analysis is on its way. And I found a keto Swiss because I was running around from pharma company to pharma company, trying to tell them like, this is the patent, please bring something to the patients and on the market, this is needed. And they were all like, oh, this is not a one target approach. This is a natural molecule that we don't want. We need something with side effects, artificial, and it has to be super expensive so we can make millions, so go away, or billions. And so I found a keto Swiss in the end, and because I thought I have to do it myself. And that's a long-winded answer. I think this is the longest I've talked in a podcast in one go, but I hope that answers some questions before we get going. And now it's back to you, really.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. It's an amazing story. It's interesting what you say about how using exogenous ketones versus a ketogenic diet is useful for scientific purposes. And I would totally agree. I see, the direct trial getting attacked a lot. You know, this is the trial where they gave people with type 2 diabetes an 800 calorie a day shake. And that was all they were eating for a period of time. And, you know, a lot of critics said, why not just give them a diet of, quote unquote, real food that's low carb. And it's all those points that you said, you know, it's really, you're in control scientifically if you're just making one very specific change. And it means that your results are going to stand up a lot better. And it also provides an actual, you know, single item that doctors or individuals can use to help people. I think it's just a tool, isn't it, in the end? It's another tool on top of dietary change.
It's a tool, exactly. With this shake, you have to be careful though, right? With the shake, you're now 800 calories, right? So you're reducing calories, which is that has a big impact on a lot of things, right? Also with this shake, you're now introducing fatty acids and maybe even bad fatty acids. So a shake is not as clean as adding one substance and not changing calories. So with the shake, even with the shake, and you think now we're in control, you're changing a lot of variables at the same time. With a diet, obviously you're adding much more. And if you're not putting patients, I think the ideal thing would be putting patients into a clinic or into some kind of a setting with closed walls and a locked door, and you give them the same thing every day, and you know what they're eating, and you photograph their food, and you know that they aren't running to the whatever grocery store and having something else, or at a party and are cheating. So you're more in control. That would be more to a real life setting. But this would be, it depends on the question. The question is, what does ketosis do, right? Then, or what do ketone bodies do? Then really, in order to answer that, you really just have to add ketone bodies. If you want to know what does a well-formulated ketogenic diet do, then you have to put people into a prison and just feed them ketogenic diet food, right? And maybe different ones, because there's ones with dairy, there's ones without dairy, there's carnivore, as we discussed before. There's a more moderate ketogenic diet, there's a super strict ketogenic diet, there's a no-carb ketogenic diet, there's so many different ones, paleo, non-paleo. So there's so many things you can tweak with, and it's all super interesting questions, but it's all super expensive and hard to manage from a scientific perspective. But I would not, just because I don't want that people think that I'm advocating just having exogenous ketones and eating a crappy Western diet at the same time. That's not what I'm saying, right? I mean, even if you decide to not go full ketogenic and experiment with exogenous ketones, and some patients that I know have done that with success, I would always advocate whole foods, low carb diet at the same time. Maybe you can cheat here and there because life's worth living. Sometimes you just have to also... cater for your psychological well-being. But in general, I would say food, let food be thy medicine, and the rest is a tool, as Ali said, on top of it, to help you stick to that behavioral change in the long term.
Yeah, that sounds like very sensible advice. And I tend to agree about doing scientific studies on diets, specific diets. First, when I started looking at the nutrition science world, I was quite disappointed that nobody had gone to the trouble of doing high quality trials like that. But like you say, if you really wanted a clean result, you would have to lock people away for a long time. And it's kind of, you might get volunteers, but it's bordering on unethical. And it's also going to be very, very expensive.
Yes, I do. I was almost recruited. If I would have been in the US, I might have joined. I think this is happening now. And it is extremely expensive. And if you take part as a participant, I think you're being locked away for 3 months. But not in a prison. It's actually very nice. It looks like a hotel ground and you can go outside and it's just got closed borders, but it doesn't feel very enclosed, and you can do home office and you get fed one of three dietary conditions. And so this is actually exactly what I talked about. Food is measured. They have to eat everything. The people that run the trial know exactly what is eaten and what isn't, and you can't buy anything else. And you just have to be there, right, for 3 months. And I think participants get thousands of dollars to take part, and they live and eat for free. And then also, I mean, you have to pay for everything else. So it's an amazingly expensive trial, but I think it's the only way you can do it. Because yeah, any food diaries don't work. I mean, ask myself, did I have for whatever lunch a month ago? Who knows, right? Or the snack goes forgotten. But I think it's actually happening, which is amazing. And I'm waiting for these results. But good times for us food nutrition enthusiasts, for sure.
Yeah, it'd be great to see. Some of what you were saying about your background with migraine resonated with me. You know, I remember having to be carried from, you know, one room of the house to my bedroom because I just couldn't move because a migraine had come on, and, you know, the pain and the nausea was too strong, and I had to just lie down with my eyes closed. And then that was me, you know, for the next 18 hours or something. And
yeah, crazy.
Everyone has, I think, so I'm 36 now, so we're talking nearly 30 years ago when this kind of thing was happening. And there was nothing, there was no good information. You know, just like you said, the idea of what a migraine is still cloudy. And actually, although I don't believe in homeopathy being effective, the closest that any doctor got was a homeopathic doctor that my mum took me to, and they suggested an elimination diet. Now, the problem was that they did what a lot of people do mistakenly, which is suggest that you eliminate one thing at a time. And of course, if you have multiple triggers for whatever illness you're doing an elimination diet for, if you only eliminate one thing at a time, you're never going to discover what is triggering your problem. So, I mean,
I was doing it the wrong way around. Usually you have to eliminate everything and introduce one thing at a time.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the gold standard, right? And it's amazing how many practitioners still say one at a time, so that you don't, you know, this, you know, insert an unscientific phrase like shock the system, or, you know, make it too difficult for yourself or whatever. But it's been interesting for me working out what my migraine triggers are. And I mean, the triggers, I suppose, are the things in your environment that can bring them on. Maybe you can talk about them and tell us what yours are, and, you know, maybe are migraine triggers different for men and women?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. And I was looking at these for years and years, trying to figure out what the hell do all these different items have in common, right? And they look seemingly completely unrelated. If you look at things like typical migraine triggers would be skipping a meal, that's a certain one, not drinking enough, but then also weather changes. Exercise is a very potent trigger. Alcohol. Some people claim foods like chocolate or cheeses, but there's not much evidence to support this. Oxygen lack. So if you go high altitude, it's a very potent migraine trigger, also used in the lab. There's certain chemicals that can trigger migraine apart from alcohol. And then there's, of course, stress. Everybody reports either stress or the relaxation, so changes in stress levels. Then I guess stress, kind of psychological stress, is in the body very similar to physical stress. So exercise is a very potent migraine trigger as well. But then you have things like weather changes also. And even that can be explained these days. Or odors, you know, perfumes or other fragrances can also trigger migraine. And then intense sensory stimulation that could be visual or maybe even auditory. So you have these stroboscopic lights sometimes on television or in the cinema that trigger epilepsy attacks in a lot of children. They can also trigger migraines, for example. And those are the most common triggers, I think. And meanwhile, I can say that they all have one thing in common, for sure. All of these things actually elevate oxidative stress or reduce energy availability in the mitochondria or in the cells. So alcohol increases oxidative stress, very, very easy. Skipping a meal decreases energy availability, for sure, unless you're in a ketogenic diet. But even then, if your liver isn't working well, skipping a meal can be an issue. If you don't drink enough, your energy production will be impaired. If you don't have oxygen, enough oxygen, your mitochondrial function, energy production will be impaired. All of this increases oxidative stress. Perfumes contain more toxins than smoking, possibly. So perfumes are the new smoking. And most perfumes are not even even controlled by any authority, and they have substances in there that are actually forbidden in Europe, but nobody checks it. So perfumes come with toxins. They just basically help the smells stick on your skin or even stay in the air for longer, so that this perfume is like acting for whatever, 24 hours. And a lot of super sick patients are perfume intolerant. It's not the fragrances, it's the nasty chemicals that are in there. And in your nose, actually, for you to be able to smell means the blood-brain barrier that is protecting your brain from chemicals is actually leaky, because otherwise you can't smell. So this means these toxins go straight into your brain. And this is why there's this multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome that a lot of CFS or ME patients have. And I used to suffer from that as well. So I can tell I'm still very smell intolerant. Not very, there's much worse patients, but some kind of a washing powders or detergents are super bad for me, but it's those that have the chemicals. So in a way, a migraine you can be very grateful for, because it usually warns you if something is really off. And this could be that fragrance. So that, and then you have weather changes. I always thought, oh my God, this must be some kind of a placebo effect. But no, if you have, for example, low pressure means less oxygen content in the air. So even with things that seem so unexplainable, like weather changes, you can tie it back to mitochondrial functioning. So I think that that was probably all of them. Oxidative stress in exercise is increased, of course. So exercise is usually not a good thing for migraineurs, especially high intensity interval training is the worst. Even though everybody says it's the best thing to do, don't. Because if you have problems with mitochondria, right, then they cannot fight off oxidative stress as well. And high intensity interval training is increasing oxidative stress at the maximum rate. If you cannot get rid of those oxidants quickly enough, your DNA is damaged, your enzymes are damaged, everything is going downhill. I used to do this because I thought I have to, and everybody says it's good, and I was sick afterwards for 3 weeks. Migraine and then flu-like symptoms, your immune system is down because that cannot tolerate oxidative stress as well, so everything goes downhill. So yeah, observe yourself, and a migraine typically comes on with a delay. It can be immediate, but it's usually with a delay. So if you're watching your trigger factors, you have to be aware that a migraine can happen up to 24 hours after the initial trigger. And that makes it so hard. For most people, it's around the 8-hour mark, but it's individual. So it could be the migraine last night that now at 3 a.m., the alcohol last night that now at 3 a.m., you have a migraine. Or early morning migraines can also be hypoglycemia. So just low blood glucose, right? Because you can't eat in the night. I think, does that answer your question well enough, Ellie?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it echoes with my experience personally. When I was young, it was skipping a meal. So I would have toast or cereal for breakfast, and then sometimes I wouldn't have lunch. And if I did that, then I could almost guarantee a migraine. And, you know, nowadays I get them less and less, but I think... you know, a change in weather is certainly one of mine, and eating certain things can be. Although interestingly, I've had success with vitamin B12 supplementation, so particularly methylated B12. And I mean, pernicious anemia and other autoimmune diseases run in my family, so being low in B12 is not a surprise. I guess I think I could have had high homocysteine levels, and the proper B12 could have helped me to clear that better. But do you have any insight as to why B12 sometimes helps with migraines?
No, all B vitamins, there's a lot of things. Well, firstly, I forgot to answer part of your question. You asked whether there's differences between males and females in trigger factors. So let me just quickly say a sentence to that, and then back to B12. So yes, I mean, with a guy, you basically have a stable system all months, all year, all life around, right? Your hormone levels never really fluctuate. with a woman, it goes like this all the time. And in the different parts of your cycle, different hormones are acting protective or less protective if they're not there. For example, estrogen plummets just before your period. And estrogen is not just a female hormone, it's also a potent antioxidant. For example, it determines insulin sensitivity. So these hormones are very delicate interplay with a lot of other functions in your body. Now, when estrogen plummets, it can't be antioxidant, you're not as insulin sensitive, so your whole metabolism doesn't work as well, then a period is actually stressful. So cortisol is rising, so blood sugar goes up, and all those things. So a lot of women are prone to a migraine just before or during their period. And this is a menstrual migraine. Obviously, a guy wouldn't have that. But even here, sometimes metabolic changes can help, because if you're not as insulin sensitive and if you're having less crappy food around, oxidative stress levels are lower. And some people also just at the beginning or 2 to 3 days prior to their period, when they become very vulnerable to a migraine attack, they just take some exogenous ketones constantly, and that helps them as well. So there's some things that you can play around with and figure out whether this helps. And this comes back to B12. Now, in general, there's actually quite a lot of studies accumulating that substances that can support mitochondrial functioning obviously help with migraine. And this can be CoQ10, this can be riboflavin, so vitamin B2. This can also be other B vitamins, and in your case, B12. And basically what you're trying to do is, it's a bit like if you have an engine in your car, and that is supposed to drive you as quickly and as fast and as clean as possible. If your oil is missing, right, and there's no water in the tank, and your wheels have holes in them, even a good motor, even a good mitochondria, a healthy mitochondria, isn't really able to work very well. And the same is with a car engine. The engine, even if the engine itself is not broken, which in a lot of migraine patients, that will be the case anyway. But if the other things are missing, and that would be mitochondria, coenzymes, vitamins, then you don't have the building blocks. You will not be able to drive fast with that car. And so the first thing I have, basically, when I try to, and this is just my approach, and I'm not a medical doctor. I have to, I completely forget to say I'm a doctor, but not a medical doctor. Nothing I say is medical advice. Please go to anyone you trust and who has that certification. I'm just talking about experience here. But if I were a medical doctor and I was seeing patients, then I would probably adapt my four-step approach. The first one is, make sure your mitochondria have what they need to work with. And in your case, you have a familial history. It's good if you then check your homocysteine, if you check your vitamin and mineral levels, and you see that there's nothing lacking. Now, this could be even if you're lacking magnesium, it's another very potent coenzyme for mitochondria. Now, again, you're not performing well. You're not making the energy you need, so you're constantly running into a migraine. So first step, making sure your mitochondria have everything they need to work well. That's the foundation, right? Secondly, you want to eliminate as much oxidative stress as you can and increase your endogenous antioxidant capacity. Now, this means oxidative stress is in any toxins. So get rid of non-organic crap in your diet. Don't do the mistake and think you can eat keto with crappy meat and intestines, especially liver, most toxic. Probably fish is not a good idea for you anymore, because fish is full of heavy metals. Just an idea. Be careful with iron. Iron is very pro-oxidant. Free iron is toxic to your cells and your brain. Can cause Alzheimer's. I used to have a huge iron cast iron pan, and every time I was frying something in there, half an hour later I would get a migraine, and that was the iron that was leaking out of that, right? And then increasing your antioxidant capacity in your body, you have to be in a balance between how many free radicals can you catch and how many are you ingesting. And this could be via supplements, for example taurine or a good antioxidant supplement. And also, I think once you decrease what you're taking in, your body can fight it more as well. But there's several things you can take for increasing antioxidant capacity, depending on your genetics, for example. And then the third thing is keeping blood sugar stable. Now, in a migrainer, you have something called insulin. Well, it's not insulin resistance. It's more like reactive hyperinsulinemia is what they say. And that means basically your thermostat in your body is broken. If a migraineur is ingesting a certain amount of glucose, usually they're not performing as a healthy person. If you think of a thermostat in your flat, right? If your flat is too cold, the sensor senses that, increases the heat ever so slightly, measures again. Once you hit the temperature you want, it's going to stop sending more heat, right? In a migraine patient, this would look like, oh, it's too cold. Now we're increasing the heat. We're increasing it too much. Now it's too hot again. We're turning it down. Now we're too low. And it's a constant fluctuation. And in terms of insulin and glucose, this means if you're ingesting glucose, your body already in your gut is sensing how much glucose is coming in from the receptors in your mouth, from your gut. And then it's releasing and making exactly the right amount of insulin that is needed to take that sugar that you've just ingested out of your blood and into your cells. Then you're back at baseline. Perfect. Done. You're not craving any food. You're fine. You've eaten. You're satiated. Good. In a migraine patient, too much glucose, simple glucose. Now the body is firstly struggling, like how much is coming in. We don't know. Oh, now there's too much glucose in our blood. We need to send out a lot of insulin. It overreacts, sends out a lot of insulin, gets out, sucks out all the glucose from your blood. Now you're hyperglycemic, even though you've just eaten. Half an hour later, you're craving food again. You're shaking, you're a bit nauseous, and now you've overdone it and you're worse off than you were before. And this also happens during the night, for example. Now this is reactive hyperinsulinemia or reactive hypoglycemia. And that happens in a lot of migraine patients. And that means you can completely circumnavigate this if you're low carb or sticking to complex carbs, and then you don't have that. And that could be a migraine trigger. Now, this is the third step. And this is ideally done with whole foods. Now, usually that goes hand in hand. Eliminate the crap. As a migraine patient, you can't tolerate that. And the fourth step now, if all of this is not yet helping, then you need to offer the brain an alternative energy substrate. And this is where ketones come in. Lactate might work as well, but there's not much research on that yet. So I suggest ketones because there's so many patients this has helped with. So you can do that with a ketogenic diet, eliminating carbs, not completely eliminating, but checking how much carbs can you tolerate. You also have to check whether you can tolerate dairy. A lot of migraineurs can't, or at least some points they can't, right? Some people react to dairy with insulin, so then they're hypoglycemic. You also need to experiment with sweetness. Not many people can tolerate sweetness very well. Maybe stevia works for you, maybe erythritol, maybe you have to get rid of that as well. Watch out for the nuts. Don't have too much protein. Those are some mistakes. And if you figure out that is not for you, or for whatever reason, you're adhering to the rules and you cannot get into therapeutic levels of ketosis, so above 1 millimole, then you can think about playing around with some high quality exogenous ketones. I would always take D-beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is the endogenous version. So that's very important. You don't want to introduce something that isn't human identical, at least for me, because that will stress your body potentially more. And then also very important for a migraine patient is increase your salt intake, high quality salt, prior to an attack, but also with your meals. Usually those guys are low blood pressure and they're not taking in enough minerals. And so a Himalayan salt or a stone salt can do wonders. That's another tip from my side. Maybe lastly, because you asked, we still can't figure out what a migraine actually is. I think maybe we can now. And this is a bold claim, but we recently published a paper in Nature Neurology on the metabolic face of migraine, which means I think migraines are at least partially a metabolic problem. And this is the interesting thing. I used to be mad at my migraines crippling my life, but actually I think that migraines from an evolutionary perspective are a warning sign. They're evolutionary important. Now, if you look at diseases, and migraines, actually 15%, so 1 billion people in the world have migraine. And now the doctor is trying to tell you this is a disease and this is something that is maladaptive. This doesn't make sense. So if every seventh person in the world has a given genetic background, a genotype, or at least a phenotype with some kind of a variation in genotype. So migraines are very complex, but they lead to the same or similar phenotype. This cannot be an evolutionary mistake. Monogenetic diseases, yes, they're rare and they're a mistake. And those people wouldn't have survived. But I think migraines 10,000, 20,000 years ago had an advantage. Now there's two things to a migraine patient why I think that. A migraineur's brain doesn't habituate. Now typically, the brain is very energy hungry. So brain encodes for change. That means if I look at a white wall or checkerboard, right, my brain would not stop firing, even though the information is constant. A healthy person looks at a wall and realizes no change will stop firing. A migraine person doesn't do that. So even outside of a migraine attack, that means that a migraineur's brain is hyper excitable all the time. that, I mean, I'm not sure if that's the same for you, but I always, even as a child, I couldn't be at a sleepover because the smallest noise would wake me up, right? And that's what so many people say. Smell, noise, lights, everything is louder, brighter, and more annoying. That's because the brains don't really shut up all the time. But this also at the same time makes them very energy hungry, right? Because we're not saving that energy. But if you go back 20 years ago and you think about a tribe of, I don't know, 40 people, there was 3 or 4 people in there with a hyper-excitable brain. I'm pretty sure that was the one that saved the tribe from a tiger when everybody was in deep sleep. So that could be one explanation. And if you go back 10,000 years ago and we're in ketosis, the diet was so different that we could afford an energy-hungry brain. We were eating more fats and we were eating more meats maybe, right? We were not eating that glucose crap, highly processed, sugary food that would basically have our brain starving 2 hours after. That came later on. And I think if you look at reports, 2,000 years ago, migraines were already reported. So it's not a completely new thing, but it probably is a thing that happens since we have agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago. That's a guess. I don't have any evidence for that this is a 10,000 year old problem, but I think it's very unlikely that a migraine attack is basically just something that has lost its warning function. So pain is our most potent warning function. More potent than a migraine, I think it can hardly get more potent than a migraine, maybe a cluster headache. But then there's the other thing. Now, why a migraine? Why would this mechanism of a migraine? Okay, so migraine genetics makes sense now. Why would this mechanism of a migraine happen? Well, I think a migraine is protecting us from the effects of extremely high oxidative stress and energy deficit in the brain, because that can be harmful. What is a migraine forcing us to do? It's forcing us to rest in a dark room. It's making us sick so we can't eat. It's forcing us to lie down. Ketoneogenesis, so the building of ketone bodies, is actually initiated during a migraine attack. Unless we pop painkillers and then we eat normally, which is also, I mean, I have to say I do that too, right? But just to say, so basically in that paper, we have determined how we can get from the migraine genetics, the initial trigger factor, the energy deficit and the increased oxidative stress, all the way to the migraine actually happening. So the release of neuropeptides that hurt, the release of ketoneogenesis, hormones associated with that, the aura phase, all of this, all the way to attack resolution. And the interesting thing is, some of those molecules that are responsible for the pain, such as CGRP, CGRP is a neuropeptide that Novartis and Eli Lilly are now blocking constantly for migraine rest, that migraine injection, the new one that is currently released. This molecule is actually antioxidant. So it's part of the pain, but also part of the elimination of the problem. And at the same time, we are releasing cortisol, we're turning on a lipolysis, we're turning on ketoneogenesis. So the brain is sensing that energy deficit, and part of the migraine attack is its resolution. It's fighting the problem, but before homeostasis is basically restored, it's forcing us to rest. And I think that is, migraine has not lost its warning function, even though it's a chronic syndrome now, but that's just because our environment has become so maladaptive for the migraineous genetics. And I believe that this is why we're now having these chronic migraine patients like myself, who are in an attack all the time, because this rare situation of energy deficit in the brain or increased oxidative stress would have only happened very occasionally. And then the migraine would have saved us, right? But now it's just happening all the time. And that's not exactly the fault of our genetics or our brains or our bodies. So you don't need to feel guilty about it or hate yourself or hate your brain for the migraine. It's just that the environment we live in now has become maladapted or not suited for the migraineous genetics.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And of course, with a company called Paleo Canteen, you're preaching to the choir.
Yeah.
I think anything to do with humans at all has to be put through the lens of evolutionary theory, because yeah, evolution has had enough time to try everything. You know, it's had millions of years experimenting with us, and the ones who survived got through because of their genes, not in spite of.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, similarly, you could extend it to type 2 diabetes, where you know, there are, you know, almost everyone can make themselves type 2 diabetic, but seemingly some are more susceptible than others. So it's a phenotypical thing rather than a specific genetic disorder. And it's...
insulin resistance is life-saving, or exactly. Used to be life-saving. It's, yeah. Again, it's a physiological insulin resistance. Some people get it during pregnancy, but why? Just because if you're running around the savannah 20,000 years ago, your baby's development is dependent on glucose, but your muscles can feed off fatty acids and proteins. So it makes complete sense to turn the rest of the body insulin resistant and spare some glucose for brain and baby. That's all it is. I mean, people talk about insulin resistance all the time, not even knowing what it is. What is insulin resistance? What is turned insulin resistance? Only certain tissues and certain organs are turned insulin resistant. Not the fat cells, right? Not the brain, not the baby, but the muscle cells. For what reason? Well, for that reason. I think originally insulin resistance comes from saving the brain and the baby. And in the migraine attack, actually, curiously, the body's also turning insulin resistant. So in an attack, and that makes perfect sense again, the body is trying to preserve the glucose that is there for the brain. And that's because in the brain, we have glucose transporters in the blood-brain barrier. GLUT1 transporters are insulin independent. So that means they're not dependent on insulin as a gatekeeper to get the glucose into the cells. So being insulin resistant in some glucose transporters that need insulin, like in the muscles, spares the glucose that is there for the brain. And so if you have a more, let's say, how do I say this? A higher tendency to run into that evolutionary preserved mechanism, then you're probably more likely to get type 2 diabetes as well, which now is bad, but insulin resistance itself would have never happened if it wasn't physiologically useful, evolutionally useful for, yeah.
Indeed.
So I couldn't agree more.
And I like what Nick Mailer says about Amber O'Hearn are both very particular about language, which I like. And they, you know, he talks about chronic hyperinsulinemia rather than insulin resistance, because, you know,
yes.
One is pathological and one is a kind of ambiguous term. Going sort of moving on, but sticking sort of with insulin. How do you think migraines may relate to other brain diseases such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, if at all?
Great question. Yeah, so I guess in a way, it's quite curious that migraine seems to be somewhat the opposite problem in metabolism to the typical metabolic issues such as diabetes. So maybe starting with diabetes, diabetes is protective of migraine. So the higher the glucose levels, the less likely you're running in an energy deficit in the brain, it seems. Whereas if you have more hypoglycemic episodes in your diabetes because you're taking copious amounts of insulin, then you're again more likely to develop a migraine. And a migraine actually doesn't have the typical insulin resistance issue as you outlined, or the chronic hyperinsulinemia, which is the better word. They have the opposite. They have glucagon resistance. And glucagon is basically the counterplay of insulin. So that means that makes them even more fasting intolerant. So if you're constantly getting a migraine when you're fasting, you might be glucagon resistant. Glucagon is basically the hormone that is turning on lipolysis and ketogenesis. So that's why a migraine patient needs to be careful there. They're not typically overweight. You also have overweight migraine patients, but the ones that I saw, they're typically very skinny, those perfectionist lean persons that don't eat fat and try to do everything that they're told. And so it's more, usually it's more an opposite of a problem. Then we go to Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, I think what all of these brain diseases have in common is the mitochondrial dysfunction aspect. Mitochondrial and increased oxidative stress and inflammation play a role in almost any brain disease. And in Alzheimer's, you also have the insulin resistance of the brain component to it, which means that in 50 to 80% of cases, depending on study, have this metabolic type of Alzheimer's, which means that not even in the body, they can be perfectly lean and they can be perfectly insulin sensitive in the rest of the tissues, which is, again, insulin resistant where is always the question. But they can be insulin resistant inside of the brain. So some neurons have insulin-dependent glucose transport. And that means if then you're insulin resistant in the brain, right, That means you cannot take up glucose in those fast firing neurons that are the most energy hungry. Now it turns out in Parkinson, right, those glutaminergic cells that are the ones that are mostly dying in a Parkinson's brain, turns out that they have about 50,000 connections more than other neurons. They're by far the most energy demanding cells in the brain. Those are dying first. You might ask yourself why. Well, maybe they're starving. An Alzheimer neuron that is degenerating, maybe that is starving too. I mean, that's a simple concept. If you don't water your plant, it's dying. If you don't feed your neuron, it's dying. And most of them do not regenerate. So those dying cells, right, could be dying due to increased oxidative stress, malfunctioning mitochondria, and what they all need is energy. And energy comes in the form of glucose, and in these patients maybe not as much. Then also what they all have in common, migraine, Alzheimer, Parkinson, is probably a toxic issue. Nobody talks about this. Nobody researches on this. But you can find papers where toxins have accumulated in the brains of Alzheimer, Parkinson, and migraine patients. And again, like a bit like metabolic dysfunction and oxidative stress, toxins will damage your mitochondria. They will damage your mitochondrial DNA. And in comparison to nucleic DNA, mitochondrial DNA does not have an impair mechanism. So once it's damaged, it's damaged. You can't really get it back on track. And interesting is that, you know, at least for migraine, I know that's true. I'm not sure about Alzheimer's, but migraine is typically inherited from your mother. The major part of your mitochondria, or most mitochondria, even if recently maybe not all of it, is coming from your mother. So that means whether you have good or not good mitochondria, you have to blame your mother for it. And that's one sign that migraine is such a mitochondrial problem, is because it's typically inherited from the mother. Now, if the dad also has migraine, then you got also the genetics that are coming from the nuclear DNA on top of it. And you usually have, if both of your parents have migraine, you're usually the disaster child, right? That's the worst thing you could get. But in a typical migraine patient, it usually is the mother. I'm not sure if your mother or your aunt or your grandmother had migraine, but.
So there's some talk of my aunt kind of potentially suffering something similar, but my mum never had it, although there is susceptibility in that side of the family for chronic health conditions that I would certainly blame on mitochondrial dysfunction.
So so for me it also skipped a generation. Sometimes it skips a generation, right? So it could be also on your grandmother's side, or I think this is why, this is a very interesting question, because I think that most neurological diseases, maybe even chronic diseases, can be treated more similar than differently. And this is where the whole pharmacology and whole medicine is going completely wrong these days. They're all looking for single target solutions in form of a drug. And migraine, Alzheimer, Parkinson, they're so multigenic, so varied. They all have maybe little polymorphisms in one gene or another, thousands of different genes, in combination with a bad environment, and that triggers the phenotype. There's no way that you can find a drug that targets a single enzyme, a single receptor somewhere, even a single pathway, and that will cure that disease. It's never going to work. I think what we have to do with these diseases is something like bringing ketones, which are evolutionarily important, back into the modern world. That's essential. Changing our crappy diets, getting rid of all these toxins that are blown into the world and that we're not adapted to have around and that we're not able to detox, right? And if you do these things, then you can probably fix a lot of the neurological disease problems, or, I mean, depending on the stage you're catching them, and maybe even other chronic diseases such as diabetes. And one last thing, there's evidence that Parkinson, MS, Alzheimer's, and migraine all benefit from the presence of ketones. That's another thing they have in common in terms of therapy.
Yeah, the evidence is really stacking up. I mean, I think that if you haven't broken your leg, or you don't need some other type of trauma medicine, or you haven't got an infection and you need an antibiotic, or you don't have a genetic disease that is incurable, then you're probably talking about at least 90% of the rest of it. Modern medical spending can be tied to mitochondrial function. And yeah. I would love someone to do a really strict review of of that to work it out. But that I've thought that for some time, and it sounds like we're kind of in agreement.
Oh yeah, we are. Amazing. There's not that many people that think that still, but I think it's becoming more and more obvious. The more these things are talked about, the more the patients are empowered to learn about their own conditions, I think the more change will happen, just because of the pressure from underneath, right?
Absolutely. And,
it's quite amazing that now, I mean, 5 years ago, I presented at this International Headache Society meetings, and I was still kind of like looked upon weirdly. And now all these specialists, even the ones that I saw with 16, right? They're not turning to me for advice, because I have these patients sitting there that say, I want to know more about the ketogenic diet and I want to try something different to drugs. And now they're calling me and say, well, what do I do? What do I tell them? How does it work? So just after this, in like 10 minutes or so, I have another call with a medical doctor who's now calling in, and a second one after, want to learn about ketogenic diets and ketosis in general. So things are changing. It's amazing. And I think they're changing because of the informed patient.
That's really fantastic. Yeah. And I think the doctors being on board is really what's going to change things, because they are probably about the most trusted profession in any Western society. And they're starting to try it with their patients, get positive clinical results. They're finding out that if there is a risk, they haven't found it yet. And you can't turn that back. You can't put that back in the box. That's irrefutable.
And more patients being cured, or at least almost getting rid or reducing their migraine frequency drastically, and they shout it out in the world. And so I think with time it will get better. I'm going to try and write a PDF, a small how-to kind of manuals, because it's only so much time I have, and there's a billion people in the world, and there's a lot of neurologists as well. So maybe just to raise a bit more awareness, I'll be able to send that out to people so they help themselves with the help of a medical doctor who's on board.
That's great. That's a goal.
And then, yeah, videos like this on migraines or other diseases, I think. One video at a time and one patient at a time will hopefully get rid of this problem long term, or reduce it a lot.
Absolutely. So where can people find you online?
So, well, meanwhile, you can find me on KetoSwiss. So if you want to know when we launch a product or want to stay informed, you can. We also have a blog on anything health-related, alternative, complementary medicine, from vitamin C over the benefit of chocolate, how to choose a very good olive oil, all the way to what can ketosis do, should you be eating meat or not. And that's www.keto.swiss. And then you can find me on social media, me or KetoSwiss on everything. Elena C. Gross, I think, is the one on Twitter, but I also have a YouTube channel. Try to upload some videos sometimes. I haven't done it in a while, so maybe I should. But yeah, this is where you can find me. You can just post questions under the video, or contact me on Twitter, Facebook, wherever. I mean, Facebook is hard because there's too many people writing and I can't answer everyone. Also LinkedIn. And then hopefully more videos will come up, and also the PDF. I will have a website soon where I can link to papers that are relevant on this, and maybe papers from others, papers from myself, maybe more videos. And I promise now, because that's going to keep me accountable, to write that PDF, distribute it for free, on how to tackle the metabolic problems in migraine. And that will be posted on the website and everywhere, I think.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ali. It was great to talk to you. Real pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and see you next time.